Hi, my name is Maria Martinez, and I'm here with Emma Nguyen and Spencer Cox, and we're interviewing
Sarah Nunez.
We're at the Extra Room Library, and it is March 9th, 2018. We can just start with a simple question, I guess, maybe. Where were you born?
I was born in Bogota, Colombia. Yeah, in 1978.
Were your parents born there too?
My dad was born in Bogota. My mom was born in Florida.
Okay. How did your family come to the United States, specifically your dad?
Mm-hmm. My dad came to the United States it might have been around 67 or 68. His brother, Max, was studying at NC State, I believe, in Raleigh, North Carolina. And so he came to live with his brother. And he finished high school at Broughton High School in Raleigh. And so he was kind of like a foreign exchange student, like came as a international student, if you will, to finish out his high school. And then he ended up going to college at Campbell College in North Carolina. But he met my mom in high school.
Did they go to the same high school?
No, she went to Sanderson, which they had a friend in common who had introduced them. And that's how they met. Yeah, I mean, in North Carolina in the late 60s, you know, there weren't a lot of Colombian men, you know, kind of going to colleges, you know, going to high school, as, you know, so he was, you know, real different. And of course, you know, came with, you know, English was his second language. So I know my mom has always shared stories of just how different he was, but how intrigued she was with, you know, how, you know, his difference. She was raised in Syracuse, New York, and moved down to the South, to North Carolina. I think I can't remember if it was late middle school or the beginning of high school. And she remembers that being a really kind of traumatic experience for her, having come from a little bit more of a progressive place in the North to the South, where they wouldn't allow you to wear skirts to school that were shorter than your, like when you put your hands down your legs, and if the skirt was longer than your fingers, or shorter than your fingers, you couldn't wear it. So she remembers being sent home from school to change because of rules like that, that were really just not, she wasn't used to. But they did not go to the same high school.
How would you define your community as a child?
I think there were probably a lot of different communities. I mean, there was our family community, which was made up of, you know, cousins, my mom's side of the family, who lived in Raleigh. My dad's side of the family, who was Colombian and mixed with, you know, Caucasian, white, European ancestry. And they lived in Charlotte, North Carolina. And then my family from Colombia, who would come and visit every few years. And every time they would come to town, we would do big things like go to Disneyland or go to the beach or do, like, you know, because all the cousins would come together and the aunts and uncles. So I think there was family community, which was not super like centralized. Like, this was really just me, my mom, my dad, my brother, and, you know, we would have like family get-togethers. So it wasn't as if it like was a everyday community, right? We had a church community. I was raised Baptist, and we went to church every Sunday. We had Bible studies at our house on Saturdays, and we would even sometimes go on Wednesday nights. I acted as a child, and so I would be in plays a lot, act in plays, like the church plays, during Christmas time. I remember once I played the angel, and I got to like ride this like cloud. They made it like a cloud, but it was like it went from like the top of the, you know, where they play the music and they kind of mm-hmm. conduct the sound and stuff for the church, from the top there all the way to the stage. I got to ride this, like, they made this like pulley thing, kind of like, you know, like a zip line through the church for this play, and that was a really cute memory. So there was the church community. We had a neighborhood community too, so I played a lot with people and my kids in the neighborhood. We played kickball. I rode my bike a lot. In the summertime, I would go to the pool every summer. My brother recently reminded me that we would be left at home alone at pretty young ages. Like, so he's 2 years older than me. So I might have been like 8 and he might have been like 10. So like after school, you know, we would be home alone with my parents, worked until my mom would come home maybe at 5 or 6, and dad would come home usually at like 8 or 9 because he was a car salesman. And so we had the neighborhood community, and we would play outside in the summertime, go to the pool. And I think that's probably about, school, right? I mean, there was school community. I don't remember a lot about having like consistent friends like throughout childhood up until I was 14. I have friends that, you know, I have been consistently in my life, but previous to that, I don't have memories of having like really, really close friends. And that might have been a function of just moving. You know, we moved, I think, when I was 5, and then again when I was 7 or 8. And then again when I was, I think, 13. So because we moved neighborhoods, I changed schools. But the school community, I guess, was also sort of a community. But I never quite felt, necessarily, like, really accepted at school. Mm-hmm. Or, like, a part of a community at school. I mean, I loved school and I loved learning, but I don't feel like I really related to my peers. I don't remember having like deep relationships built with people or teachers that I really connected with. And so I don't know if that was just more of a function of me being a little bit more of a loner and just kind of doing my own thing. Is that why? I don't really know why, like, where the memories are there around whether or not school felt like community for me. But now, in my sense of knowing what community feels like, I mean it just wasn't like, maybe it just because it wasn't a nurturing environment. And I remember at such a young age kind of being asked, like, you know, why I looked the way I looked. And I don't think young people back then had a lot of experience with mixed kids, people that came from, you know, 2 different cultures.
Was the school environment, like, more, like, binary? Like, there weren't a lot of Latinos?
Oh, there were none.
No.
I didn't meet people who had similar backgrounds as me who were raised in the United States until my 20s. Yeah.
Did you grow up speaking Spanish?
No. So, I think for my dad, I mean, I think that sometimes, and if my mom had spoken Spanish, or more fluently, she did speak Spanish. She lived, they moved to Colombia in 77. My grandfather got really sick. He had a stroke, and so my father was really close with him, and they moved to go help take care of my grandfather, and so I was conceived and born there. And so my mom lived in Colombia for think at least 5 years. So she spoke Spanish. Mm-hmm. But because it wasn't her first language or primary language, like in the household, we didn't do it. And I think back in the 80s, you know, it was more about like assimilation and acculturation than it was about like, oh, well, let's have this blended family have like a experience that felt, you know, and honored both cultures. I think that the times that I was around Spanish was always when my cousins or my mom and or my dad would talk to his brother over the phone. My dad would talk to his mother over the phone. And then when the family came. So no, we did not speak Spanish at all, but I did take Spanish. So all through elementary school, and I believe in middle school, I know in elementary school, I got Spanish. And I don't know if it was one of those experiences, kind of like what people are faced with today, where their counselors tell them not to take Spanish because, oh, why would you take, you have a Spanish surname, so, or Latino surname, you shouldn't necessarily need to take Spanish, you know? But I remember feeling, actually going back to that memory, I can remember the trailer that it was in. You know, schools had trailers, like you'd have your main building and then the trailer, and I remember the Spanish room, and I really loved that space. Seeing all the, you know, pictures of Latin America on the wall and having a teacher that spoke. I don't remember the teacher very well, but I definitely remember the trailer and what it looked like. We used to play kickball and basketball and stuff out on a ramp or in a on a you know pad like a asphalt area really close to that trailer, and I can remember, you know, just having an admiration for that. But no, we did not speak Spanish growing up. It wasn't in the home on the regular, but it was there in pieces, you know. And I think we didn't have Spanish language TV. It wasn't like Spanish language radio was even really big. So had we had like Univision and, you know, shows and channels like that, like, or we had lived in like Miami or LA or Chicago or a different place, like the exposure might have been a little bit different. But being in Raleigh, North Carolina in the late 80s or mid 80s, like, or throughout the 80s and 90s, like, it just wasn't around. Tiendas, like, not the part of town that we lived in. I mean, looking back now that I know that area, I think there were definitely Latinos living there. It just wasn't, we were in a, you know, kind of a middle class neighborhood, predominantly white. I mean, times have changed a lot now in North Carolina, but I mean, there's Latinos. Like, it's you know, a very big population, and it grew like by 100%. And from between 2000 and 2010, the population's like, I mean, it's just a very big population, especially in the Raleigh area. But yeah, no Spanish growing up. I wish by the time I turned 20, I went home and I spent time in Colombia, and I went home to Colombia. It always felt like growing up that there was something missing. There was a part of me that wasn't quite connected. And I don't know if that was because I was born there, that I needed to be connected to the land and the people and the customs and the culture. Because my cousins who weren't born there, I don't know if they felt the same way. I mean, I know I have one cousin, Paul, who was very, like, wanted to learn, you know, like, learn Spanish. He married a Costa Rican. They have a child together. Like, he went to Colombia, spent time there. Like, he was one cousin who I think was felt really connected. But when I went back is when I learned Spanish. That was in the year 2000, so we're close to 18 years ago.
What made you choose the career you have now? Like, what was the process and obstacles?
Well, going back to the story of going to Colombia, so I always thought I wanted to be a botanist, and I wanted to study plants. They just intrigue me, and I love, you know, the process of how they grow, and I want to say their anatomy, but that might not be the right word. Is anyone the anatomy of the plant? especially flowers and identification of trees and flowers. And so I thought that was where I was going to go. And I had dropped out of high school, partially because family problems. I, you know, got in with the wrong, not necessarily the wrong crowd. I mean, I was just hanging out with, you know, folks that were really interested and into jam bands and, you know, sort of the counterculture of the Grateful Dead and Phish and P-H-I-S-H, Phish. And, you know, this culture of, like, you know, going to concerts. And I, you know, started making handmade jewelry and, like, handmade clothes and just really enjoyed that life. And because my home life wasn't as stable, finding community and finding family outside of my family through these, you know, concerts and through these experiences and, like, drum circles and, like, finding spiritual space and getting you know, turned on to different types of philosophical, like, mysticism and, like, you know, kind of like self-help type stuff, like the Celestine Prophecy, and really getting into, like, you know, who are we as humans and why are we here and what's going to make us, like, be the best people we can be and, like, understand our realities and our impact on the world. And so, having dropped out of high school at the age of 16, so I finished my sophomore year of high school and I did not go back. And it was probably the best, like, not at the time looking back, like, you know, I should have finished high school. There were other things that I probably could have, you know, done to propel myself and have a different kind of future. But in the end, it actually turned out to be a really good decision. Partially because there were people and situations that I was involved with that could have gotten me into a lot of trouble. And not sort of being in that community, moving from Raleigh to Cary, like all the transitions that happened after dropping out of high school. My mom was has bipolar disorder and was put into a mental health hospital for several months during that time as well. So my mom and dad's relationship was fairly rocky growing up. They got back together and divorced, or separated and got back together. They never divorced, but separated and got back together probably a total of 8 times and throughout my childhood. And so this time when mom was in the mental health hospital, we were living with my father, of course, because mom was in the hospital, and they were still together, but, you know, the transition of kind of dropping out, the family issues, moving to a new town, like 30 minutes away, it wasn't like that far away, was really a pivotal time. And, you know, yeah, so back to the question of career, right? It's not like, you know, it's like point A to point B or this linear path, right? It's this big, huge spiral spinning, you know, like, journey of, right, all these experiences that were tough to go through, but also, like, led me to where I am today. So the dropping out of high school and then the big transition, you know, at 16, and then the big transition to a new town with all of the familial problems that we had going on, while I'm, like, working at, like, pizza shops and, like, saving money so that I can get to the next concert, the next round of concerts, because I would go for, like, 4 or 5, like, a week or two at a time, and would, like, go to, like, I don't know, they would play, like, every night. They might skip a night, but, you know, every night in different towns. So, you know, Charlottesville, Virginia, Charlotte, North Carolina, you know, they'd play all over North Carolina, Atlanta. And one summer I actually went on tour. So I started with them in Colorado and went all the way to Vermont. and then back over to Chicago. So that was the summer of 95. And so all of those experiences, right, like, land me at about the age of 18, again in a big transition, and decided in 97, I came out of that lifestyle and was like, you know, it's a fun lifestyle. It's not that I didn't go see shows anymore, but it wasn't the central part of my life anymore, because I knew that I wanted to do more and I wanted to kind of take a different route. And so I moved to Asheville, North Carolina with my brother and two friends. We left my dad in Raleigh. Mom was already in the mountains with her sister and her brother-in-law. My cousins, like, for some reason, the family kind of always sort of followed each other. So my aunt and uncle that lived in Raleigh and had cousins in Raleigh on my mom's side of the family, everyone moved to the mountains of North Carolina in the late 90s. And so we followed. We went to. It's a beautiful place, healing place, a spiritual place, mountains. And so it was in Asheville, North Carolina, where I really, like, found myself. And I think did, like, a really deep, deep work on myself in an emotional and spiritual way. And so, you know, because it's kind of the mecca of spirituality. Like, you can find acupuncturists, healers, herbalists, you know, beautiful land, farmland, like, all this, and people that have been, like, doing that work in that part of the country for a really long time. So it was really a healing place for me, and a place that I, you know, I still call home. So back to the career, in that transition of moving to Asheville, I went back to college. And it was in college where I took botany classes, and I was like, I really want to do botany as a major, or environmental science, like, focused on the environment. Like, I can save the environment. We can save the environment. This environment can be a better place, you know, with the work that we do, or I could do in it. However, when in 2000, at the age of 20, I took a semester off of school. I was working in bars at this place called Jack of the Woods, which was a local brewery, and they also played bluegrass music and old-time music, and it was a very good job. Like, I bar-backed, but I made really good money and was able, because my family couldn't provide for me, you know, I had to work and pay my own bills and all of it. And luckily I got, you know, because of my citizenship privilege, I was able to get, of course, you know, FAFSA and scholarships and, you know, different things like that to fund my education. And so, but my education took a really long time because of a high school dropout. I had to do all these remedial classes to, like, catch up to the level of, like, English and mathematics that I didn't have because I didn't finish high school. So I had to work really hard, you know, to catch back up. And so it was taking me a while. Like, I think I was in the community college system for about 3 years before I actually got my associate's degree. And I took off a semester to go back to Colombia. And it was in Colombia when I started seeing everything. Like, those moments where, like, you're like, oh my God, everything has just come to, like, a culmination. And, like, I understand even more about myself, because I had done that healing work and been in Asheville and really moved out of being, you know, in this sort of counterculture of seeing concerts and, you know, living that kind of life, to, like, learning and getting back into my head and into what it felt like to be in academia. And, you know, and I think that was where, like, the trip to Colombia plus, you know, coupled with, like, humanities classes. I can remember a professor of mine named Gigi Durbala, who I took humanities with, who taught us about, you know, the Harlem Renaissance and, you know, Gauguin and these amazing artists who impacted the world so much through their art. And I started to just see life in a different way. And I think it was education that inspired me not only to have this, like, deep desire for the environment and for the earth, right, but also this deep desire for, like, humanity and what makes us who we are and why are we these living beings on this earth taking up all this space and doing all this harm, really, like, to ourselves, but also to the environment. And so when my trip to Colombia and I saw, you know, kids on the street, you know, selling roses at every corner and, you know, being in Bogota and experiencing like everything. So not only was I like learning about myself and my culture, I spent a month and I stayed with my aunt and I got to know all my family. Like, I remember one of my cousins, Diego, he was like, Sara, you know, like more family than I've ever met. Right. But that was my journey. Right. I was like, I was there to like find that part of me, like my identity that I'd always been missing, like always been missing. I remember the bocadillos and the like arequipe and the coffee and the smell of my grandmother's suitcase when she used to come visit. Like the whole place smelled like that, you know? And so like the whole Colombia smelled like my grandmother's suitcase, you know? I mean, like, I mean, even as a kid, like, I think I would like just sit by her suitcase and just smell it because I loved like what it did. And then the tastes of, you know, all of these amazing foods that I was like, they're so good, but like, I'm not like I could sense it with my senses, but I couldn't feel it with my body, you know, with my like soul. So being in Colombia and going there like was just transformative on every single level. So not only could I taste the bocadillos and taste the arequipe, but I also started like being able to like taste things that I'd be like, I know this so well. Like, why does this? And I would, avena, right? Avena. And even like the alpina avena that you can buy at, you know, the stores, a los mercados. I remember trying that for the first time, and it might have been in a bag, you know, this like liquid oatmeal in a bag. That was like heaven. And I drank it and I was like, why do I know this so well? And I think I called my mom and I was like, I don't even know what's happening to me right now, but like I'm drinking this avena thing, avena alpina, and I'm having like this like super amazing experience. Like, it's reminding me of all these things. And she was like, Sara, I used to feed that to you all the time as a child. Granted, I came to the States at 3. What kinds of memories do you have as a 3-year-old? Right? Like, not a lot, but like the taste, the senses were the things that like ignited, you know, me. And so at the same time as I'm 20, I'm having this like huge transformative experience, and I'm seeing all this poverty, I'm seeing all this divisiveness between color, the colorism inside of our communities, you know, the anti like the Afro Colombians that, you know, are being displaced, you know, experiencing what it's like to live and see, you know, military, you know, men with big guns. I mean, I'd never seen anybody like that on the side of a road, you know, just like walking down the street and here's someone in a green, you know, like the army, I guess, or the police. I guess it's really the police, but they're like armed. And my grandmother lived really close to the training ground for the army in Bogota off of 93rd Street. And so, so I spent a lot of time in that month with my grandmother and my aunt. And seeing all of these issues, I was like, man, I don't know if I need to save the environment. I probably need to work on saving myself, right? And saving people. When I say saving myself, not like I'm in danger, but like, how can I be the best person that I can be and give back to the world in a way, through a deeper understanding of who I actually am? And I want to do humanitarian work. Like, I want to be like a social worker, I guess. I didn't know what to call it back then, right? Because I was kind of like, what is this? Like, how can I make a career out of like, not so much like studying people, like an anthropological way, but like more like sociological. And so I got back to the States, and I loved it so much, I went back. And I went back for 3 months, and I took my brother. And so between the year of 2000 and 2001, I went back to Colombia 3 times. The third time I stayed for 6 months. And I taught English and I really entrenched myself. So I ended up actually taking off in total, I think, a year of college. So I ended up going back to college in 2001. And I graduated with my undergraduate. So I got my associate's degree, went straight to college, and in 2 years I got my undergraduate degree in 2004. And in between that time was able to actually go and spend time, a total of 9 months, almost a year, in Bogota, living and like learning and being entrenched and taking Spanish classes, like higher upper level Spanish classes, working, living on my own. I took some pottery, I met friends, I traveled, went to Cali, went to Cartagena, Isla del Rosario, all that beautiful stuff, and got to really experience my family and my community, and kind of create a community in Bogota. So that's how I chose, I would say, like, the work of, accompanying our Latino community here in the United States around the issues that are most pressing for them. I think higher education I chose is a little longer of a little bit of a longer story, but decided to choose education. I think I've spent time in nonprofits, in government, and in education, and I find education to just be more of a nurturing environment and the kind of place that I thrive. And I think when choosing a career, it's best to find the type of environment that you want to be in, also plus the work. And so higher education just is the right match for me. And whereas I enjoy working with nonprofits, but it's not the most, hasn't been for me like the most nurturing environment, because there's so many different moving parts that have to be, like, you have to raise money to even like have staff and fund yourself, and it's a constant stress and sort of a constant thinking 3 years ahead of yourself. And as good of work that is, it's just not the environment that I thrive the most in. But I think finding education, finding higher ed. My first position was at Western Carolina University. I was based on a community college campus working with students who were transferring into the four-year process, right? And since I had done the GED, I had gone to AB Tech. I had done that work already. I'd been on that campus for 4 years, knew all the professors, like was really a part of that community. School at that point felt like community to me. The people in my classes, the teachers, the connections I made, like I just, maybe I didn't have it as a young person, but when I turned 18, like, and that big transitional time of moving out of Raleigh and into, having dropped out and everything, I just decided to take a different kind of path and a different perspective on life, because I had done so much internal growth as well. It was like, I need to make the best out of the situation. And so really made a community for myself on that campus. And so going back to work there, I've stayed for almost 5 years and helped transition students from the community college into the four-year school. So making sure they took all the right classes to make the process super smooth, and so they wouldn't waste time, in the 2 year taking stuff that wasn't going to help them to get to the 4 year. And I loved that work, absolutely loved it. And I did a lot of, that's when I started expanding my work out to Latino students, because I was bilingual. I'd spent so much time, working with some local nonprofits on boards of directors and things, and working around immigrant justice stuff. I thought, like, it's a population that needs our help. So I started doing presentations to churches and doing a lot of college access work, access to college and how to apply and do the FAFSA and get scholarships and all of those things. And so my work allowed me to do some of that work as part of my job, knowing that that was a growing population. And I still to this day work with Western Carolina University. I'm on their board of visitors, which is like a step down from their board of trustees. And I meet with them, and we convene in the Asheville or the Western North Carolina area once a semester. And I get time to sort of help think about the vision and the future of the university through the eyes of someone who not only is a graduate, but used to work there and who still remains, you know, in the field of higher education. So, so I love that work. And I did take a second, I took 2 years off from higher ed, and I went and I ran a nonprofit. I was the executive director for the Asheville-Buncombe Community Relations Council, which is similar to the Human Relations Commission. But we were a 501c3, so we were not a governmental organization. We were quasi-governmental. A lot of our funding came from city and county and the housing authority. And we worked to do a lot of mediation for cases of discrimination. We worked a lot around EEO and fair housing and police community relations. And that was right around the time when Trayvon Martin was killed. And so there was a lot that started to, like, a lot of community issues started to, I mean, there's always been community issues, you know, when the KKK came to town, or when crosses would be burned in people's homes, or when outside on people's yards, you know, and acts of violence against people of color. And so the Community Relations Council was always that place where people would go to get help, you know, for themselves, for their families, and then from the community at large. And so I did that work for 2 years, and then launched a national search for a position back in higher education. I was ready to move from Asheville. And I applied for about 50 positions across the nation and interviewed at about 12. And U of L was the first place to offer me a job, and I took it. Had never heard of Louisville, Kentucky. I think I might have heard of it, but I wasn't quite sure what was happening here. It wasn't on my radar. I was looking in places like California, Colorado, Washington, Nevada, Texas, Florida, North Carolina. And so, but I knew I wanted to go into working with Latino students on a college campus doing intentional programs. Because previous to this, I, you know, was working more of a broader population.
Were there obstacles you faced based on your race, ethnicity, or gender identity? Specifically in your career search?
I think in our field, in the field of education, in the field of nonprofit management, and even government relations stuff and community engagement, there's not a lot of people that have the body of work that I've built in my lifetime. So I'm not sure that, I think, like, I wonder if it wasn't more of a hindrance or if it was actually more of an opportunity, because being bilingual and having lived in the South most of my life and having gained all this experience, you know, starting from a very young age, but work experience, I guess, you know, gave me a lot of opportunity. Because in the South, I don't feel like there's a lot of folks. You know, and I think in the field that I work in, too, it's so important to know the community and to either come from the community or be willing to build relationship, deep relationship across sectors. And so, you know, even though I didn't come from Louisville, I mean, I hit the ground running pretty quickly. But, I mean, maybe age, because I think sometimes I was younger and trying to get positions that, like, you might not have been old enough for yet. So I think it was a big stretch for, you know, when I went to go work at the Asheville-Buncombe Community Relations Council, I think I was 32. It's young to be an executive director. I mean, that's, you know, but having gone from high school dropout to executive director in whatever time that was, 16 to 32, I mean, I worked a lot between those years. And so I guess there, I mean, I don't remember there being, like, an outright, like, most of the positions I've gone out for since I was 21 and been in professional fields have been ones that required bilingual or preferred bilingual. And because I think I have that, I don't know that it ever gave me a, like, I think it always propelled me further into being able to do, you know, the work in the area that I was interested in doing it in versus it being like a bad, like a, you know, discriminatory thing. Gender, I think the field that we're into is very, it's very women heavy. There's a lot of women in education, a lot of women in nonprofits. Yeah.
How has your work in the community, like Mi Gente, Leo, and your other projects, influenced the work you do here at the university and the cultural center?
I think the work of the Louisville Latino Education Outreach Project was really started here at U of L. I just came in and kind of infused it with energy and coordination and time to be able to help it be more successful. But it's a great project because it connects us back to community partners and to leaders in the community who are on the ground working with students who are probably going to end up coming to U of L. And so in essence, I'm able to have connection with them and have us come together on a monthly basis so that we can share resources, to network, and you know, and to build relationships so that we can have a stronger core of people working for Latino students in the Louisville area. And so that's huge, right? Because here at U of L, if I'm able to have contact and access to students before they get here, the impact is gonna be stronger because they're gonna already know us and they're gonna already feel comfortable and feel like the cultural center is a place for them. And so I think that's one way that it's influenced the work here. My work with Mi Gente as an organizer, I mean, as a, you know, Mi Gentista, is like more of a personal drive. I think, again, it's the first time that I felt as if I found people who, in a group, who had the same ideals, values, you know, background as I did. And so there's definitely like a familial, like it feels like, again, a little bit like home, like a, at least a political home, which is something I had never experienced. You know, it'd be like the Democratic Party or different parties or different kinds of groups reaching out because they need a Latino presence, but I've never found a group that was organized for Latinos, by Latinos, on an agenda that we care about, saying what we're gonna do, not going into a group that's telling us what to do or needing our voice because they need diversity. Does that make sense? So we, so I think with Mi Gente, how it influences my work at U of L is, I mean, from just a social justice perspective, I mean, being able to understand what's happening on a national level currently under this administration with the deportations and the raids, and knowing that that's happening in Philly, St. Louis, LA, Chicago, like everywhere, Georgia, North Carolina, right? That sanctuary cities and sanctuary churches are being established as a place to create safe place. I mean, that's all sanctuary is. It's just a safe place. And so knowing that that kind of work is happening in other places, you know, is helpful to influence kind of what we're doing on a local level in Louisville, but even more so from the students' perspective and their families, because a lot of our students have mixed status. So even though you or I might be citizens, you know, we probably have family members that might have, or, you know, an undocumented status in some way, or have been out of status, or who maybe have permanent residency and never got citizenship and have issues with, and have a record and then have issues now with being able to get full citizenship privilege. So I think being able to understand that on a deeper level helps a lot when working with students. Following this immigration issues is like really hard to keep up with because it's changing so constantly. Like by March 5th, we needed to have a decision on DACA. And is the executive order and the rescinding of DACA actually going to hold up in the courts? And I mean, there's so many things that are happening even on a statewide level around legislation, and so anti-immigrant legislation, that I think, you know, just knowing about that stuff and seeing how it's playing out in other areas in the country is super helpful, at least in my own personal understanding of it, and then when working with students and families, you know, helping them to, if resources are needed, getting those resources to the families, information, helping people to, like, it's just really complex and really hard to understand, and if you don't follow it on the regular and keep yourself well-read and well-informed, like, it can, in 6 months, it's going to be different. And so there's just a lot to keep up with, and being part of Mi Gente helps me to stay in the loop for the benefit of the students.
Besides, like, the deportations and stuff, do you see the election of the current president affecting the community in a different way, on, like, a micro level?
I mean, I think, I think what happens inside of an administration doing that, what they're doing to our people today, I mean, it's terrorizing, it's fear ridden, it's very hard for families. So I think the mental health impacts, people's ability or feelings of wanting to create community and have deeper relationships with their church, with government, with people outside of their communities, like, becomes even harder, right? And so then what effect does that have on the long term, on the families, right? And being in a place that says, we really don't want you. So then being able to then, like, thrive in school, right? And have – I mean, there's the stressors are just intense and the traumas. And I don't know that there's enough mental health ability, you know, like, and bilingual trained folks out there that can actually serve the communities and all of their needs. And inside of our population and inside of our culture, it's not a – welcome thing to go and seek out therapy. You know, you don't talk with your other people outside of your family and your preacher or your pastor, priest, about your problems. So I think that at the core of who we are as a people is really being challenged. Yeah, and I don't know what the impacts on the long term are going to be. It's really kind of scary to see that our population might end up, you know, not being as educated, not being able to access as much wealth, right? A similar story is exactly what's happened in the African American and Black communities. I mean, the system is set up to make us fail, and the system's working. And so we've got to fix it. We've got to do something, like, not tomorrow, you know, today. And I think that's what drives, right, the social justice and the activism work that I'm involved in, is that there is not one more family needs to be deported, not one more family needs to be separated, not one more young woman needs to be traumatized by ICE showing up at their home and taking their father or their mother away. Not one, like, this cannot continue to happen. And the fact that we're allowing it, you know, I met with legislators recently at the Immigrant and Refugee Rally Day, and we had legislators just look at me and say, it's not on my radar. Immigration is not on my radar. To me, that's like, wow. Anybody that says that, it's not something that it's okay, let's get you up to, let's you think about, if it's not on your radar, you know, what kinds of glasses do you need to put on so that it is on your radar? What do you need to see so that we get it in front of you? But because the media is saying, oh, we're deporting criminals and terrible people, it's like that's what people think, but it's not what's actually happening. And so I believe that, you know, now is the time. It's not about tomorrow. It's about saying today we need to work on being able to create a place. We maybe can't do it nationally. If we can't do it nationally, do we do it statewide? If you can't do it statewide, do you do it in your local, right? It's like right in your neighborhood, right in your backyard, right with the people that you have access to work with on the daily basis. And so my access, right, is the students and their families, and through some of the organizations that I volunteer with, and hoping that as a community-wide effort, we can move closer and closer to a place where these kinds of practices are not tolerated. not even just not tolerated, are like completely abolished. Like, we cannot continue to create a system like this. But it's, you know, follow the money. And it's all based in a very racist, you know, system that's set up to, you know, benefit a few and, you know, over-militarize our communities and criminalize our people, which, you know, feeds right back into war and into what's really driving all of this. And that's the part that I think we've lost our humanity.
Did you ever think about going back to Colombia and doing this kind of work there?
I don't think that I would be able to, because I don't, people that do this kind of work in Colombia usually end up missing or dead. I mean, that's at least what I've learned in the past, that there's, you know, because Colombia's also got a lot of different, it's a lot of different layers, right? With the paramilitaries, with the guerrilla, with the government. There's a lot there that, like, it's just, it's very, there's a lot. With the drug war, with the cartel, it's just, it's a lot. And I don't know that, I think it's safer to do this kind of work in the United States, even though it's still not safe, but it's, I mean, the activism work, like working in higher education and working with students, I don't feel, you know, like that's work that's, puts me in danger, but, you know, some of the other things are. Yeah, but I mean, I've thought about moving back to Colombia, yeah, and being there and spending more time there. I just don't know that I would be able to really do the deep work. And I believe that the, you know, the rural South, the southern part of the United, the eastern part of the Southeast, eastern United States is in an area of deep need. And I feel like it's really where, I mean, although I call Colombia home and it's kind of where my roots are, parts of my roots are planted, and part of them are in Asheville and in North Carolina. When I even take it a little deeper, it's the South and the Southern United States. And I mean, I just feel like my work is here. When I was younger, I would have maybe gone and, you know, done some deeper, gone and worked with Witness for Peace or done some humanitarian type of organization, you know, spending a year or something like that. But it just, my life wasn't set up in a such a way to be able to really do that for a long period of time, because my family has always really needed my support, and I, you know, want to be close to them. I don't want to be too far away from my mom and dad and my brother. So for those reasons, I stayed pretty local.
My last question. How do you self-identify with the Latino culture now as an adult and through your transitions and everything?
For a long time, Colombian American, I think, would be first, just hyphenated identity, because I have both Colombian citizenship and United States and citizenship of the United States. So I have two passports and two IDs and my cédula colombiana, my social security number in the United States. Like, right, I have those and I hold those two different pieces. So Colombian American feels right. But I've really started to embrace the term Latinx over the last 2 years or so. Just, it feels like I can wear it. Like putting on a t-shirt every day. And it feels like, okay, that feels all right. But it doesn't identify necessarily all of the parts, right? It's not just being Latina or being Latinx or being Colombian American, right? It's, in essence, I'm Sara Cecilia Nunez Man. And that says it all, right? Because Sara is my first name with an H, which is, you know, Hebrew, and Sara from the Bible, who was married to Abraham. Cecilia was my grandmother's name, my grandmother on my father's side, Colombian, dressmaker, fierce woman. Nunez is my father's, you know, last name. I was married for 12 years, and I did not take my ex's name. And so I kept Nunez. I mean, I couldn't let go of it. And I'm proud. I'm glad I did that, because I ended up getting divorced, and it turns out that, you know, it was a good decision. But Then Mann, M-A-N-N, is my mother's father's last name, who was from Germany, or immigrated from Germany, married my grandmother, who immigrated from Czechoslovakia, whose family immigrated from Czechoslovakia. So lots of European roots. And, you know, they were based out of the North. Actually, they lived in Louisville, even, for, like, in the 50s, for, like, a year. My grandfather worked for GE, and they were here for, like, a year. Isn't that funny? And so Sara Cecilia Nunez Mann, right, like, tells the story so much better, because not only does it create this connection to my ancestors and to my people and to my lineage, but it also combines both worlds of the European, right, and the Colombian or Latin American, Spanish roots. Plus, I would say also, you know, definitely indigenous and black too. It's just, I can't follow that. I don't know where those roots are. So my grandfather on my father's side was adopted. And so we don't know what he was, but he was very, to me, he looked very indigenous. He had very high cheekbones. Came from an area outside of Bogota, more rural area. So I forget what the question was.
How do you self-identify with your Latino culture now as an adult?
Mm-hmm. So I guess there's the identifier of, like, are you Latino, Latinx, whatever, hyphenated identities, mestiza, like, you know, Chicana, right? All these different, Boricua, like all these different words that we can call ourselves. But I guess really when it comes to, read it again.
How do you self-identify with your Latino culture as an adult, hyphenated identity, etc., etc.? How did you come to that identity?
I think I answered that. But I think the part about the Latino culture now as an adult isn't just necessarily the name, right? It's, you know, it's like tacos on Friday nights, right? It's traveling to different cities when I'm able to connect with the mi gente, folk from across the nation, and learning and growing with them and understanding politics in the world, right, through our lens, through the story and the way that we want to tell it and that we want to see it and frame it and create it. I see it through, you know, artists, through poets, through my mentors, which it was an older age that I was actually able to find people that could be my mentors that had similar experiences as me. Growing up and as I was younger, it was, you know, maybe, you know, African-American and white men and women that acted as those roles for me, but it didn't come until my late 20s, early 30s that I found Latinos that I could, probably actually 32, 33, till I was able to actually find, like, and that's an older age to be able to find people that look and feel like you. So, but it's through my mentors in my older age now. I think it's through our celebrations. You know, it's, and I guess too goes back to, right, the bag of alpina, avena, the arequipe, the bocadillos, the soups, you know, the ajiaco, which I make fairly well. I just have not, it's very time consuming and I have not made it in a while, but that's something I need to do on the regular. It's through, like, speaking Spanish with my father when he calls me. It's through memories of being in Colombia and spending time with my family. And I think it's also through the lives of the students that I work with on every day, you know, witnessing their growth and their abilities and their strengths and their, like, brilliance every day, you know, reminds me of how proud I am to be, you know, a woman that walks on, kind of like walking on a trapeze, not necessarily having a root planted totally in the Latino community and not necessarily a foot planted 100% in the Caucasian white community, but a woman that kind of walks this fine line of an identity that I'm really proud of. But through life, right, there's a lot of shame that has been put on me or that I created or the societal whatever that I had to get through to like get to a point of feeling super comfortable where I am. So that's how I definitely generally feel my culture. Yeah, through the senses. Yeah. So smell, taste, touch, but not so much physical touch, but like how finding a political home and finding community and finding mentors and all of those things like touches my life and my soul to help me do the work, you know, every day.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Okay, you're welcome.
That's great.
Are we done?
Yeah.